The first American offshore wind farm has moved closer to reality. Cape Wind has gotten the go-ahead from the government to build 130 wind turbines off the coast of Massachusetts. It's not easy being green. It only took 10 years for approval. We'll talk about why. Speaking of green, with the Leaf, the Volt, and the Tesla, the new must-have cars, what better time for a film sequel, The Revenge of the Electric Car? We'll talk to the director. Finally, can science explain life's daily annoyances, from the psychology of trash talk to the physics of frustration? A new book explains why those little things bug us so much. Speaking of bugs, don't miss the video pic, Watching Ants Make Rafts, coming up after this break. Stay with us. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Got any plans to head out to the beach this summer? How about Cape Cod? In a couple of years, you could be seeing dozens of wind turbines in Nantucket Sound churning out green power for the Cape and Islands. The Cape Wind Farm just got the final green light from the U.S. government for construction to begin on the country's first offshore wind farm, 130 turbines that will stretch out up about 40 stories into the sky. My next guest says that from the beach, they won't look any bigger than a half inch on the horizon. Joining me now to talk about the project is the CEO of Cape Wind Associates, Jim Gordon. He's here with us in our studios in New York. And if you'd like to ask questions, please join us. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Welcome back, Jim.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Only 10 years, huh?
Only 10 years. The exciting thing is that a new, inexhaustible, clean resource is about to be harnessed for greater energy independence, new green jobs, more stable electric costs, and hopefully catching up with the Europeans and Asians who are putting offshore wind farms off their coasts.
So there are no more obstacles in
well,
your way.
Well, we are completely permitted now. We do have some legal challenges that the opponents have put forth. But, you know, Ira, we've been at this for 10 years, and we have met our opponents in courts or in regulatory arenas for that time, and our record has been 15-0. So we do think that the legal challenges are nuisance and designed to delay and obstruct the process, but we believe that this project will get into construction by the end of the year, and we will be generating clean electricity for the Cape and Islands and hopefully inspiring other Atlantic coastal states to look at tapping their offshore wind resources also.
Can you make it cheap enough to be competitive?
Well, let's put it this way, Ira. Offshore wind is a bargain when you consider the external costs of burning fossil fuels and generating electricity with nuclear power. As you know, mining and extracting coal and oil and natural gas, they take a toll on the environment, our health, and military expenditures in order to protect Persian Gulf supply lines. So when you look at the costs that we avoid by using offshore wind and other renewable energy resources, it's competitive.
And in the cost per cents per kilowatt hour to the consumer, is that price competitive enough?
Right now, the cost of offshore wind, if you look just at the comparing it with the kilowatt price on your electric bill,
right,
is higher. But the point is, we already see oil prices and natural gas prices and electricity prices rising. The advantage of using offshore wind is you have a more stable electric costs that are not subject to the volatility of fossil fuel prices.
And so give us a timeline when we might see the first of these wind turbines actually be erected.
We're hopeful that in 2014, 2013, 2014, we'll start seeing these majestic offshore wind turbines creating a better energy future for the people on the Cape and Islands.
Mm-hmm. Just to go over the numbers again, I'm talking 130?
130 wind turbines that mm-hmm. will produce, on average, over 75% of the Cape and Islands electricity with zero pollutant emissions and greenhouse gas emissions, zero water consumption, and zero waste discharge.
There was news about trying to build an underwater electrical backbone up the East Coast. I'm sure you're familiar
with that. That's correct.
Would that stretch up into Nantucket with your wind turbines?
Right now, the plans for that undersea transmission mm-hmm. line goes from Virginia to New Jersey. So Cape Wind would be building its own transmission line that would hook in to the existing grid and provide this clean, renewable resource to the people in Massachusetts.
And you can sell everything that you can make. All the electricity.
Right now, we have half our power under contract. National Grid stepped up, very progressive utility. Headquartered in the United Kingdom, they've had a front row seat to the emerging offshore wind industry in Northern Europe.
Yeah, they have a lot of wind farms.
They have a lot of wind farms, and now the United Kingdom has become the leader in building offshore wind farms. So they stepped up, they bought half the power, and we're very confident that we're going to sell the balance of the electricity for this project.
Mm-hmm. And I know other states along the coast are interested in watching how yours progresses.
Well, the Cape Wind became a high-profile project, and we'd like to think that we've inspired other coastal states to look at their offshore wind resources, as evidenced by, the proposals that are coming up and down the Atlantic coast and Gulf coast.
Why is offshore more attractive than just being on the coastline?
The reason that offshore wind is more attractive than even land-based wind mm-hmm. farms is that we produce electricity coincident with the peak demand. So when folks really need the electricity, in the hottest summer days, in the coldest winter nights, the offshore wind farms will be producing electricity. And this is backed up by over 7 years of data that we've collected through our offshore wind data tower, and we've correlated it to the 10 historic peak electric days in the New England region. So, Ira, 28 coastal states consume over 73% of this nation's electricity, because that's where the population centers are and the big electric demand growth is. So by tapping an offshore wind resource right next to the load, you've really got distributed generation that's going to create a more secure, safer, and cleaner energy future.
Mm-hmm. And, people are concerned about bird deaths, bat deaths, yet environmentalists have been backing your project down the line, haven't they?
The major national and regional and local environmental organizations have backed this project, including Mass Audubon Society, that did parallel research to the research that was done by the federal government under this exhaustive and comprehensive permitting process. And, Ira, the greatest threat to birds and marine life is climate change. And Cape Wind is designed to help mitigate climate change by offsetting almost 1 million tons of greenhouse gases annually.
What was the major engineering challenge that you faced in this project?
The major challenge was definitely the permitting of the project mm-hmm. because, this is the first offshore wind project, and in effect, Cape Wind has helped evolve the regulatory framework for offshore wind in America. The good thing about Cape Wind is that the technical siting criteria, it's in shallow water, it has a low wave regime, so that's similar to the earliest offshore wind farms that have been developed and built in Europe. So
so you had a track record of how to build it in those places.
That's right.
That date back to Europe, and you can use their specs and things like that.
Exactly. And we've cross-pollinated a lot of information from Europe. We've traveled to Europe and seen a lot of offshore wind farms and talked with policymakers over there, engineers. And, you know, it will be a challenging project, but we're convinced that when it's up and running, it's going to be reliable, and it's going to be further embraced by the community.
Is the the technology, who's supplying your turbines and those kinds of things?
The turbines are going to be supplied by Siemens Corporation, which is one of the largest electrical supply powerhouses in the world. The turbines will be made in Denmark. Although we have many wind turbine manufacturers in the United States building land-based wind turbines, as the offshore wind industry progresses in the United States and there are more projects, there will be a supply chain that will develop in the United States to build large offshore wind turbines, just as they're doing in Denmark and Germany and in the United Kingdom.
And so they ship the parts over, and are there jobs here to assemble them?
There are jobs.
Create jobs out of this project.
In fact, Governor Deval Patrick and his administration are really focusing on making clean energy the next big industry in this region. And they're actually going to be building a offshore wind terminal in New Bedford, which the project will be deployed out of. There's another company that's looking at building a monopile manufacturing facility, which are the foundations of offshore wind turbines to supply Cape Wind, as well as other projects that are now sprouting up along the Atlantic coast. So Cape Wind by itself will produce about 600 to 1,000 jobs during the construction phase and 150 permanent jobs during the operations phase. But more importantly, Ira, first mover advantage, we're hoping and we're seeing already that Siemens has established their North American headquarters here. Global Marine, a major European cable laying company, has opened up a headquarters in Boston. So the center of gravity seems to be coming to locate in this region to be poised to be able to service and provide equipment for this emerging offshore wind industry.
Well, Jim Gordon, we wish you luck.
Thank you.
And thank you for taking time to be with us. Jim Gordon, he is CEO of Cape Wind Associates, talking about upcoming 130 wind turbines off of Nantucket. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Support for Science Friday comes from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. Just about 5 years ago, it seemed like the dream of the electric car was literally dead. Thousands of electric cars had been produced and leased by GM. They were taken back and literally put through that giant car crusher. Makes little cubes out of cars and things, thousands of them. A film called Who Killed the Electric Car chronicled the death of the EV1, but that was not the end of the story. Since then, new plug-ins have hit the streets. You've got the Nissan Leaf, the Chevy Volt, the Tesla. The electric car is coming back, and so is the movie sequel, Revenge of the Electric Car. And it asks the question, would you buy and drive an electric car now? Is it the right time? What do you think? Do you want a plug-in of your own? That's what we're going to be talking about. If you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI. Chris Payne is the director of the films Who Killed the Electric Car and The Revenge of the Electric Car. The new film premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival here in New York this week. He's in our New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you. One thing about watching both films, I watched both of them, we talked about them both before, is there was a tremendous shift in your emphasis. You were really angry in that first movie, and it showed, you know, who killed it. This one, you seem a lot more hopeful and accommodating in this way.
Yeah, well, it's not often that things turn around. And as someone who cares about, you know, where we're all headed, it was very nice to see, of all people, the car company switching their tune on this issue. So we weren't going to go out there and club them with giant clubs this time if they were doing actually something that I thought was a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And you focus on some of the very big personalities who made this possible in the film, right? Bob Lutz of General Motors, for example.
Yes, that probably the most unlikely person ever to embrace an electric car. But there he was. I think that they saw that the Prius had really done a lot for Toyota's brand and so forth, and that they were taking a pummeling from everybody who felt they were making lots of bad decisions about SUVs and trucks. And he thought, one more decision I'm going to make is going to be about something in the other direction. So he took on the Volt as his legacy project.
Mm-hmm. But not before he saw what Elon Musk and Tesla were doing, right?
Yeah, that was a eureka moment. I think when they saw that Silicon Valley was taking on electric cars and saying, forget Detroit, we're just going to do this on our own. If you guys can't do it, we're going to use all the know-how we have, engineering, we can do it, and we'll turn this around. So when they saw that in Detroit, not just GM, but a lot of companies said, boom, we've got to get in the game.
And why can't Tesla and Silicon Valley remain as you take over from Detroit and become the car producers?
Why not? You know, it's funny that none of the train companies of the 19th century became the car companies of the 20th. So maybe the electric car companies truly will be this whole new generation of car companies.
Mm-hmm. And you also visit Japan and Nissan making the Leaf over there.
Yeah.
And again, as a Lutz GM, it's the strong personality of one big executive who believes this and pushes it forward.
Well, I think we wanted to show in this film that it takes very strong insiders inside these big corporations to create change. It's not just, you know, some bureaucratic decision. You've got to have an entrepreneur at heart driving something. And in the case of Nissan, Carlos Ghosn fit the bill.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm going to put $6 billion on, you know, jumping over Toyota's non-plug-in cars with a pure electric car. And that's a big risk for even someone like that.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting part of the film is looking at the small entrepreneur, the car mechanics who are now in the business of switching over people's cars to electric, right?
Yeah. Well, some people say electric cars, you don't have to fix them because there's no engine in them. So what are all these people going to do without so many engine jobs and tune-ups and stuff? So, well, why not convert existing cars rather than building new ones? So thousands of converters around the world are starting to do these conversions, and we decided to profile one of them who happened to be my neighbor in the film.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How did you get the access, especially General Motors? They let you in places that are, you know, must have 500 guards with M16s.
Well, they do have a few guards. We found that out in the first film.
So after making such an enemy out of them in the first film, how did you turn them around?
Well, I think they began to turn themselves around. You know, they saw that their brand was going nowhere, and they saw maybe an opportunity in this. And we made a deal with them. We said, we won't release any footage for the next 3 or 4 years until 2011. And if you actually do this project you're considering, then we'll be able to see the footage. So that was the deal we made.
Mm-hmm. And it seems, and when you hear the Nissan people talking, and I'm sure it's true of the other car companies, it's the battery technology that has come further during the years that is making these things possible.
Well, I think on the technology side, the battery prices coming down, mm-hmm. and then being able to do a little bit more thanks to laptop computers and cell phones has helped a lot. But on the other side, the car company saw the writing on the wall with gas prices. And mm-hmm. in 2008, they jacked up this a couple years after our movie. And in the boardrooms, when these entrepreneurs went in there, they said, hey, gas prices are going up, and we better have something finally to offer people that's an option to gasoline. So I think that was a big driver.
Can they make – I think there's great demand for electric cars now.
I do
especially
too.
Can they make enough of them?
That's a good question.
You know?
The first year, they're already sort of sold out here. And the, you know, Nissan, the Carlos Ghosn came in from Japan and said to our panel the other night that they are at full capacity and they're going to try to ramp up. But it's really tough to replace a multiple hundred million car a year market with a new technology. So this is going to take a while.
Here's a tweet that comes in from Noah Talley, who says, I'd love to drive an electric car, but they don't have the range to handle my 100 miles per day or the toughness for my dirt roads?
Yeah, well, that's great. He can weight that because there's lots of people that can use a car that only has 100-mile range in the short term. GM actually bet on customers like him with his Volt that also has a gasoline engine. But for most people, the electric car is definitely a commuter vehicle right now. Mm-hmm. And what I found in my 12 years of driving these is that you actually drive a lot less than you think. And
yeah, and you said yet that you were surprised that you liked the Volt. You didn't go in thinking, well, it's got a little it's not a real electric car because it's got a gas engine in it.
Right, because you're still using the fossil fuel sometimes. Well, I've had that Volt. I bought one at full retail price, I'd like to just say here on your show. And I've driven it for the last 3 weeks, and I've got 500 miles on it and only a gallon of gasoline burned. So I can see for a lot of people, not maybe true believers like myself who really believe in pure electric, that this is really a great technology for a certain kind of driver.
Mm-hmm. And you also have a Tesla, do you?
I do. After the first film, the only electric car you could even order after we made Who Killed the Electric Car was the Tesla. So my producer and I said, let's put our money where our mouth is and get one of these cars. And I've had it for 2 years.
That was $100,000.
I know. We could buy the whole studio here for that.
Certainly our staff. But I see on their website that they're building, they have a prototype, or they're trying to build a cheaper version of it?
They have a $50,000 or less Model S, which is actually a lot more practical than that sports car. It seats 4 or 5 or 6 or something, mm-hmm. they even say. It's a really beautiful car, but that's 2012.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. I have Professor Robert Darnstone from Pullman, Washington. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, how are you?
Hi there.
Hello.
My students have taken a look at this problem, and it came from the Washington State is making an electric highway which goes from Canada to Mexico with California and Oregon joining in. And I was doing a research grant in which we developed a series of charging stations. We took that to the next stage and thought, what would happen if we looked at Highway 90 and 80 and the large highways and created a series of power charging stations across the United States and made more of a trolley system in which you would clip on and charge, so all your commuter travel is done through a trolley line, and so you're actually charging your batteries as you approach a city, and then you have battery power from there. We created a website with 100 projects which showed all of these things, from wave technology to geothermal. Each student took on a different aspect of the project, and we did that for most of the highways within the United States. The website is The Electric Highway, Washington State University.
All right. Thank you, Professor. Any reaction?
Well, one of the great things about the electric car, and I think why we got so upset when the first ones were destroyed, is they're really a great symbol of innovation, the future, the next generation. And the fact that they're coming back and charging stations are now being standardized, they have fast charging, even talking about switching stations, incredible room for innovation and people to get involved. So it's great they're doing it.
You know, the country of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Edison.
Right.
You know, the electrical guys, you'd think we could come up with something.
Yeah, I think we are now, finally.
Do you? Do you think we have turned the corner?
I do.
You do?
Uh-huh. I think it's sort of a disillusionment with gasoline, really, what happened. You know, on the pollution side, on the where we buy all our gas from, and people said, why can't we do it? Why can't we do it here? We have the smarts. Let's do it.
Why not create? And I thought when I was watching the film and talking to other people, why not create a standard sort of electric car body with an electric engine in it, you know? But then you have the choice of maybe putting a hydrogen fuel cell to drive your electric motor, or your batteries to drive your electric motor?
Yeah, that was the original design for the Volt, and I think they'll actually go back to that if they figure out the efficiency issues around hydrogen, because that solves sort of the refueling process. Now, if you talk to Tesla, they'll say, no, the trick will be ultracapacitors and a high-speed Type 3 charging, where you can do like a whole charge in 5 or 10 or half an hour.
Weren't the Israelis talking about switching out batteries in their electric cars?
Indeed, they were. Shai Gaze at Better Place has a whole system. I think they're rolling out a prototype in Israel right about now.
So instead of charging up, you go to the service station, you pull out your dead battery, and they give you You leave it there, and they give you – you switch it, basically.
Yeah, you don't own the battery pack. You just lease it. So you go to the service station. They switch out your battery pack for another one. And they say they'll sell you the power, which is inside the battery.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a phone call from Mike in Philly. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi.
Hi
there. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I live in suburban Philadelphia, and I would love to get an electric car, except that I heard that the battery life is diminished if you don't park it in a garage. I don't know if it's the heat or the cold that diminishes it, but I don't have a garage, so I'd be leaving it outside. How much of an issue is that?
Well, that's a great question. And in California, what they did, and I think even on a federal standard, I'm not sure about that technically, but they said, let's take the battery risk out of the hands of the customer and force the car companies to have an 8 or 10-year warranties on these battery packs. So I've had my RAV4 EV now for 10 years. The battery pack's been just fine. I park it everywhere. And they say that the lithium battery packs they're selling in these new cars are really tough. So there you go.
Good luck, Mike.
Great, thank you.
I've made no secret about it. I have a Prius, but I keep thinking about how can I transform that into an all-electric car. And there are people who are doing that, as you show in your, you know, not just Priuses, but Porsches and all kinds of cars.
That's right, yeah, like making them into plug-in vehicles.
Making them into plug-in vehicles.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
How much does it cost to convert a car?
I think they were doing Prius conversions for about $10,000, and that would, instead of giving you 1 mile of all-electric ranges, which the Prius can do in theory, it would give you like 40-mile range. So that's for a certain kind of person that wants to do that.
We're talking about electric cars this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow here with Chris Payne, author. He's a director of the new movie at Tribeca called Revenge of the Electric Car. How's the reception been for the film?
You never know. You edit these things for, you know, it seems like forever, but certainly for 3 years we've been working on it. And you come in and the reception's been really very nice. It was a good place for us to do this. New Yorkers care a lot about it. And we had Elon Musk come in from Tesla and Carlos come in from CNN. So it's been a very nice reception, even from cynics, because I think you'll read, it's like, oh, electric car is not going to do what I want it to do. And I think they begin to see that maybe this is part of a momentum that's bigger than any objection.
Well, you'd have to change the infrastructure, like you were talking about, and the professor was that I remember Governor Schwarzenegger was talking about the hydrogen highway and
right.
other things. You really have to think about not just gassing up someplace, but I can charge up someplace
right.
and create that structure to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the advantages the electric car has is that in garages or anywhere you can plug in, there are plugs already existing. And the Volt, for example, the GM one, wants to plug in just to the wall. That's enough power for it. So you don't have to build a million-dollar hydrogen station. But the I think Colum Technology has 1,000 charging stations in public places they've already installed. And that is coming because it's a lot of people want to see the infrastructure go in as fast as the cars.
1-800-998-2255. Quick call from Nick in Wenatchee, Washington. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how are you?
Hey there.
Hey, so I have a question just about the actual environmental impact of the electricity that we're using. I live in Wenatchee, Washington, which is a renewable energy powerhouse between its dams and solar energy.
Right.
And we have a lot of plug-in stations set up with no plug-in vehicles. And we're actually looking at having the first fully electric city trolley. So one question that I have is, if we actually get this momentum going to where the electric cars are becoming something that is more mainstream, what's the environmental impact going to be of if we don't also go with changing to renewable energy sources, the additional energy that we're using to recharge the batteries? Second part of the
let me just stay with that because we're going to have to go to a break, but it's a good point because half the electricity now is made from coal in this country. So what you're really doing is charging your batteries with coal.
That's right. And that we're a 50% grid right now, right?
Right.
Well, they've done study after study, and they go, even on a 50% grid, the electric car is on the whole cleaner than a gasoline-powered car. The Department of Energy, the Argonne Study Group, CPRI, a lot of these groups have done that study. But the point that electric car advocates make, and I think it's a good one, which is it's the only kind of the car on the road which can get cleaner the longer you drive it as we clean up the grid. And certainly you in Washington State are in a great position with such a clean grid. And on the first electric car, you know, environmental groups did not support the car. This time they're all coming to the support of it, saying this is it. Sierra Club has sponsored some of our screenings. So I think
where can we get to see the film? If you want to see the film. Is it around? Is it coming out there? Are theater near you, or do you have to find special places?
We're taking requests on our website, which is revengeoftheelectriccar.com, and then cities that make the most requests, we're going to have our premieres there. I think that's the current plan. Mm-hmm. Or just write the Sierra Club.
Sierra Club, and they'll bring the film.
I don't know. I'm just making that. I probably just got myself in trouble.
Never mind. But it did open this week at the Tribeca Film Festival here in New York.
Yeah, and we'll have festival screenings this summer.
And I've seen it already. And it's really a terrific film because it's almost like a documentary style, and it comes across very well that way.
Oh, thank you.
And good luck to you, Chris.
Thank you, Robert.
And you'll come back soon to talk about the acceptance of the electric car.
I hope that's really soon.
Chris Payne is director of the films, both films, Who Killed the Electric Car, and now the current The Revenge of the Electric Car. And if you want to see the film, you can go to revengeoftheelectriccar.com and request it for a screen in your city. We're going to take a short break and come back, and we're going to be really annoying. What makes you annoyed? Scratching cell phone? We'll talk about how to get really annoyed. Ooh, can't even think about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, a global affliction for which we are all at risk. Here are the symptoms. Flushed face, sweaty brow. In more severe cases, surging blood pressure and a feeling that your skin is crawling. Ugh, no one is immune and there is no cure. Worse yet, the causes lurk around every corner, maybe even in your own home, like lip smacking, loud eating, pen tapping, long lines, cell phones. Of course, I'm talking about annoyances, the little things in life that other people do that get a big rise out of you. Can science explain why that happens? That's the subject of a new book by NPR's Joe Palca and Science Friday's own Flora Lichtman. They're here to chat about the science of what bugs us. And we want to know what annoys you, what boils your blood. Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Welcome to Science Friday, Joe and Flora.
Thank you, Ira.
Thanks.
Do the same types of things, Joe, annoy most people, or specific things for specific people?
We figure that if there are about 6.2 billion people on the planet, then there's probably about 6.1999 different opinions about what's really annoying on the planet.
That's an annoying statistic.
It's really so subjective. There are things that seem to cut across populations. You described some of them. Cell phone seems to be the modern most annoying thing. But really, it's amazing the diversity of the things that annoy people. I mean, the one that's really stuck with me as I've been going around lately is this person who was really annoyed when people picked lint off her clothing. And I've been thinking about that. I mean, who?
It seems too personal.
How often does that happen to you, Ira?
You've broken the 3-foot zone on. I have actually seen people do that.
Yeah.
While you're talking to you, they're picking off
the lid. Talking about it. It's sort of intimate, and maybe that's the problem with it. But, Joe, it's true that we did find a few things that seem to be universal annoyances, these annoyances that transcend race, gender, age, you know, ultra annoyances. And one, I'm gonna play an example of one right now.
Let's hear it.
Oh, I can't listen. Oh. You mean it was that sound of the Apple computer being turned on?
Should we hear it again?
That could be one of the annoyances.
That one really bugs me.
It was a double annoyance.
Yeah, really.
Go ahead. Let's play one more time
okay, just to really okay. give people the painful.
Oh, God. do you know, Flora, I've seen people rip their headphones off when they're watching that, because that's a part of the movie that, that Flora made, and it's so painful for some people, they just cannot stand it.
And it's what's amazing is that researchers have actually looked into why.
Fingernails what is, yeah, on finger, the chalkboard.
Why fingernails on the chalkboard is so annoying.
They really have studied
there's
that.
There's been a study on this, Ira. It's kind of amazing. It turns out that it seems to be something about this mix of frequencies that really does annoy people. And part of the theory is that it's the change in volume quickly over time. When you run your fingernails down a chalkboard, you have this sort of slip and stick production.
I'm trying not to,
to cringe.
Picture that. Yeah.
And that means that the volume changes quickly, and our ears don't really seem to like that, which may explain why.
See, but this is a case where the modern world may have solved that particular annoyance because blackboards are disappearing.
Ah. So, but their cell phones have taken over.
Right, exactly. We'll find something else to be annoyed by, no problem about that.
Yeah.
Styrofoam, I think, was the other one that people really find, you know, when you rub two pieces of styrofoam together, that can be pretty horrible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true. The cell phones one, actually, the king of annoyance himself, Larry David,
of course,
took on cell phones on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Maybe we can play a clip from it. Let me set the scene for you, though. Larry David is sitting in a restaurant next to another guy, and this other guy is on his cell phone chatting loudly, and you can sort of hear him. And then Larry David starts to get flustered and then begins talking to his what he calls his other self across the table. There's no one sitting across from him, so he's having a one-sided conversation with no one. So let's hear it.
I got someone on the line.
So I was trying to brush my teeth with an apple. It was horrible. Horrible.
Excuse me? Who are you talking to?
Talking to myself.
Well, you're doing it really loud.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
You're kind of talking loud yourself.
To a person.
What's the difference?
I'm actually conversing with another human being. Very
oh, really?
Different than just...
To shout. The outside observer, it's the same level of annoyance.
You know, of course, that would be Larry David because he probably wrote that and other annoying thing on a Seinfeld episode where he gets a crank phone call. He gets a phone call and he says, "Can I call you back at home?" He says, "No. Well, why do you think you can call me back?" Right?
That was a great scene.
But that's annoying too. That's an annoying thing at dinner time to get those phone calls.
But Flora found out, and there's some really interesting research that shows that there's a particular reason that this other person's conversation that you can't listen to, it actually played in both directions here. It's like you can't stop listening. Why can't you just ignore that person? If it were just noise, if it were just random noise, you could ignore it. That's what the research shows. But because there's content, your brain gets sucked into the conversation, and then you can't ignore it. And you want to, and you can't, and it's really annoying.
Mm-hmm. Here's a tweet that just came from the music junkie who says, "Slow talkers who have a lot to say."
Oh.
That wouldn't be us, would it?
You know, let's not even get into that because there's a lot to talk about there.
Well, it does seem that there are some annoyances that sort of prevent you from achieving your goals, you know, or slow you down in some way. A slow talker with a lot to say is kind of like sitting in traffic when you think about it, because, you know, you're sitting there, you want to keep moving forward, you want this conversation to keep going.
And just think of all the annoying people and habits in traffic, in drivers, the things that drivers do.
That seems to be a minefield for anyone.
Yeah, Joe, you're a bicyclist all through traffic. So
I was just going to say, I've been telling people, I was turning into NPR on my bike the other day, and I was waiting for traffic to stop so I could make a left turn, and this woman coming past me in the other direction was applying mascara as she drove down the street, and I thought, holy smokes, that's annoying to me because I want her to be paying attention to where she's going.
Wow. So how do you narrow, when you write a book about annoyances, how do you narrow it down with all the things that are going on?
That's a great question, Ira. Yeah.
I'm all the smarty pants comments that are coming to mind, I'm filtering out right now. But the answer really was that I think, Flora, you'll agree, it was the hardest thing about the book in writing. It was like we had a blank canvas and we had to decide where to go. Because a lot of times, you know, if you're doing like electric cars, you talk to the electric car expert. I mean, it's not a problem, but there is no expert in annoying. And so we wound up going to physicists and acousticians and psychologists and anthropologists, all kinds of people, lots of things that we talked about that didn't get into the book. That's for, you know, annoying volume 2, I suppose. But it really is the kind of research topic where almost every field of science has something to say about it. And it was really just a question of finding the interesting anecdotes, because you name it, and there's something to do with annoying in that field of science.
Let me give you a very far out example. We were thinking, you know, is there a physics analog in annoyance? Can a material get annoyed? And it turns out you do a little web searching, and there's a branch of physics about frustration in materials. Glass, plastics, they get frustrated. But the biggest frustration in materials is in magnets. Magnets are just very prone to getting frustrated. And what it means is that the atoms within them want to arrange in a certain way, and they want their electrons to spin in a certain way. And in some materials, there's a conflict between how they arrange and how they want their atoms to spin. And very frustrated materials kind of don't know what to do about it. So they cycle through all these different things. They can't arrive at the right answer. And they're really frustrated. That may sound familiar to me.
This gets into the But this gets into the difficulty about, you know, parsing what's annoyance versus frustration. I mean, of course a magnet doesn't get annoyed as a human gets annoyed, but there are overlaps. I mean, I started asking you know Bob Hazen, I started asking him, he's a geologist or geophysicist, about what annoys a rock. You think to yourself, a rock? But I decided that a lichen annoys a rock because it basically gets inside of it and starts breaking it apart. So there you go.
Well, but you're just assuming that.
Yes, like most of this book, Ira.
Right. What? Yeah, exactly.
But there were some sort of interesting studies that you looked at, Joe, about what annoys other animals.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because you know what scientists do, Ed, you've covered science your whole life, is they find an animal model for being annoyed. Is there an animal model for an annoying thing?
Well, you know, I think probably the most interesting was this strain of mice that were developed at Jackson Laboratory called the fierce strain. And this is a mouse that's missing a particular gene that makes it really, really irritable. So at first, you know, I was cautioned by the researcher, we don't want to anthropomorphize. We don't want to call this annoying. We can't ask the mouse if they're annoyed. You know, okay, I get it. And then she went on to give me chapter and verse about how this mouse acts really annoyed. And when you try to, lift it up, instead of just hanging there like a normal mouse, would it tries to bite you. And so she has used this particular genetic defect to look for similar things in human subjects, because humans have the same gene, and what happens when it's mutated, and do you find this as something that has an underpinning of human annoyance? And Flora has looked into some of the diseases, the human diseases that are represented initially by an increase in irritability. So you've got to believe that there's some biological thing that's going on. And yes, so you start with animals. It's quite common. I mean, you start with fruit flies. You start with stickleback fish. We found that sticklebacks were studied by famous ethologists, in understanding how they behaved. And a famous experiment of them getting crazy when they saw a red mail delivery truck. And what was that about? Well, it was a projection of the mail coloring when a rival swims into the tank. So a lot of things to learn about annoying from the animal kingdom, for sure.
I wonder if there's a lot of things to learn about how to cope without road rage, so, you know, how to cope correctly from the animal kingdom so they don't eat each other up. And
well, you know, that's to take that a little bit, I mean, I know it's a kind of a funny question, but we've come to a conclusion, a tentative conclusion anyway, that a lot of annoyances are sort of a product of the modern civilization. So that things that once upon a time, if you did this to me, I'd just kill you because I could. Now we've all been socialized to know that that's not an appropriate behavior. So we have to internalize things that we would otherwise act out on. And so I think, you know, there's something to be said for understanding how to control your emotions, because it's part of what allows civilization to work.
Well, I want to thank you both, Joe Palka and Flora Lichtman, for taking time to be with us. The book is Annoying, the Science of What Bugs Us. And it's available, I'm sure, everywhere and online. Thanks, Joe.
You bet, Ira.
Speaking about bugging up, Flora is still with us here, and our video pick of the week has to do with bugs.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, we are just up on the bug beat. We're not going to let you miss one bug story. So this week, top of the bug news, is a study about how fire ants, if you take a sort of glob of them and stick them in water, or let's say their nest floods because it's really rainy, they form together, they join together and form a raft that they can float sail on for weeks.
I couldn't believe it. I didn't even know ants could do this.
Me neither.
But then you show that somebody sort of dumps a whole bunch of, must be hundreds of ants in some water, and instead of falling down and drowning, they create this beautiful circle raft.
That was the other thing that's so amazing. It's not just kind of a motley raft. It turns out that it ends up being this sort of perfect circle. And it happens. This is what the researchers were looking at. Can you look at the ants' individual movements and figure out how they create this? You know, because we don't really know what's going through the ants' minds. But it turns out if they move randomly, and then when they hit the edge, they stop moving or they turn back, eventually, just sort of the law of averages, you get this beautiful circular raft. And it carries these passengers for weeks, and it turns out, you know, I was curious, how do the ants breathe underwater? Because some of them are submerged, right? So part of what keeps the raft afloat and allows these ants to breathe is that there are air bubbles trapped between the ants' bodies, so they can sort of sneak a breath here and there.
Wow. It's amazing. And then the other part of your video pick of the week has to do with
caterpillars and robots.
Yeah. What a combination.
I know. You wouldn't think. This is the best part was the researcher, Barry Trimmer, was like, you know, it's weird that we're looking at caterpillars, which don't move that much, to make a robot move. But caterpillars have a few tricks for getting away quickly. They can roll up and kind of shoot away like a wagon wheel. And so you can see that happening on the video. And he's interested in making a class of soft-bodied robots that don't have hard parts. And the advantage is that they can sort of inflate or deflate. They could go through tiny little holes. So if you're trying to navigate complex terrain, or let's say you're the Mars rover and you get your wheel stuck in the sand, you know, you could just change your shape and get out.
Right.
And that's the sort of advantage of figuring out how to make these soft bodies move, which is not trivial.
No, it isn't. And you show how the caterpillars can squeeze through those little places. And it's up there on our website, on our video pick of the week, up on the usual left side on our website. And the ants making these rafts, which I still can't.
They're amazing engineers.
And how they know how to do it in unison. You know, it's things about all these colony sort of insects.
These social insects.
Just together without any sort of, how does they communicate with one another to say, build that raft, get it circular, everybody do it.
Yeah, I mean, I asked, how do they know? Who's in charge here? And, you know, of course, no one knows how they know how to do it. But it does seem to be an adaptive strategy to deal with. They hail from the rainforest where it's rainy.
Yeah.
And this is how they survive.
Great videos. It's our video pick of the week up there, Flora Lichtman's creation, up on our website at sciencefriday.com. Watch those ants build the raft, and then watch this robot caterpillar. Doubleheader.
And you can do the ant experiment yourself, it turns out.
You can.
Get some gloves, first of all. Find a fire ant nest. This is what the researcher said.
Find a fire ant nest.
With your gloves on.
Carefully.
Carefully. Dump them in water and you'll see for yourself.
Yeah, under supervision. Thanks, Flora.
Thanks.
I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.